The Evolve Network is now live at evolvenetwork.tv. Subscribe for meal plans, recipes, cooking shows, and our very own The Magic Pill and The Magic Plant, as well as access to my favourite documentaries. The Evolve Network is also home to our full library of podcasts, with new release podcasts airing first and in full on the channel. You can also watch selected vodcasts in a video format. Meanwhile, enjoy this highlight of our podcast and head over to evolvenetwork.tv for the full Evolve podcast experience. The Evolve with Pete Evans podcast is a conversation about my favourite ingredients for a healthy human experience. We take an informed look at topics that include nutritional and emotional well-being, as well as expanded consciousness. I love exploring the topics that are not traditionally taught at school and take a deep dive into them with my special guests. I invite you to sit back and come along for the ride with an open mind and heart, and please share with your family and friends, as these podcasts may just be the seed from which many things will flourish from. Cheers. We've been using Waters Co. water filters for the last 10 years, and I wholeheartedly trust my family's health with them. Waters Co., established 1977, have personal and domestic water filters, which turns your ordinary tap water into great-tasting, alkaline, ionized mineral water, which removes up to 99.9% of fluoride, heavy metals, chemicals, and bacteria, so you can love your tap water again. The Bio 1000 is the latest edition of the BMP 1000 model and the culmination of over 40 years of experience and research into water filtration by some of the world's leading scientists. Waters Co. was first to market with natural gravity-fed systems, creating alkaline water way back in 1984, and have continued to lead the market in research and development, setting the benchmark for all other brands to follow. Please go to my webpage, PeteEvans.com, to learn more and to receive your special discount from my link on the products page. You're going to love it. Richard, how are you doing, brother?
I'm doing well, thanks, Pete. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Thanks for joining us. It's always good to get an introduction from a dear friend such as Alex to say you guys should connect. And I'm fascinated to learn more about our understanding of finances, currency, where we've been and where we're going. And I nearly feel like after watching your first film that you surmised it so well. But I'm really hoping that you can educate everybody as to your wisdom in this whole mess that we find ourselves in at the moment. Because I was trying to explain it to my mum this morning, and I'm not the most eloquent person when it comes to regurgitating information. I understand it, but then getting it out there to people is not one of my strengths. So do you mind if I hand it over to you and you just run with everything you can download in the next sort of 60 minutes?
Absolutely. And I think you've hit the nail on the head there about the fact that money and finance and economics is a complex topic that's hard to it's hard to understand and hard to explain. And I think, you know, I often reflect on the way it's taught in schools, like, I think back to my own education, you know, and I was interested in economics and, you know, studied it at school and at university, but that experience sort of almost turned me off it. Like I just couldn't keep it up. I sort of dropped out because the way it was taught, I just found to be not interesting, not relevant, too complicated, you know, too theoretical in some ways, and like almost like deliberately opaque, like that it's this black box that you're not supposed to understand. Like these people in suits in the government or in the central bank, you know, they and the banks, they understand how this works, and leave, they're the experts, leave it to them. But yeah, and no one's really taught much about money. You know, kids growing up, what is money? You know, how does it really work? It's all sort of taken for granted. Like I think back to, you know, my first economics class. You know, maybe I was in year 10 or something like that, and you open the textbook, and the first page says something like, "Oh, there's this thing called the business cycle. So like, you know, there's this graph of a wave going up and down, which is explaining something like, you know, we all kind of sort of intuitively know about this. Like there's booms and busts, like, you know, there's good times when business is booming, everyone's doing well, everyone thinks they're, you know, getting wealthier. And then all of a sudden, like something goes wrong and like there's a crash and all of a sudden it goes in the opposite direction. And we saw that sort of back in, you know, the great financial global crisis of 2008. It was like this crash and all of a sudden, you know, the economy goes off the rails, and then you get you know, the next 10 years or so, you get a good run where everything seems to be going well. And then last year we saw it happen again, like the stock market crashes. And so that was sort of on the first page of the textbook, as if it was like a given, like an axiom, like that's just the way it is. That's the way an economy or a market works if it's just left to itself. But the government and the central bank, their job is to smooth this out, this process, and help it along. And so that, you know, that was also on the first page of the textbook as like a given as well. Like that's the role of government, is to help the free market along. And so that, you know, it sort of went from there over the years, like most of the focus is on how the government and the central bank can intervene in the economy and make it better, you know, never questioning the fact that, of course, you know, never really thinking that through or trying to go back to first principles and dig any deeper into that. And so I guess I sort of, you know, although I stopped studying it formally, I maintained this kind of amateur interest in money and economics and banking. And I sort of became aware of this entire other school of thought in economics, which is called Austrian economics. And it's called that because the guys that sort of developed the school of thought were based in Austria, you know, in Vienna. A guy called Karl Menger, you know, back in the 1800s, developed this line of thought. And it's like, when I started reading about it, it just made so much more sense to me. Like and so I wondered why I'd never heard of it before, even though I'd been interested in economics all my life. And it was almost like it was deliberately not taught in formal education. And it sort of took a much more, what seemed to me, common sense approach. Like it instead of starting at this arbitrary point, it really went back to the beginning and said, okay, what are we trying to do here? What is economics? Like in its most basic sense, it's human beings kind of trying to, you know, take actions to get the things that they want. Like it's sort of, you know, and they can, to do that, they sort of have two options available. They can like look around them and use the natural resources that they find in the world and kind of transform those things into goods and services. And then they can also trade those things with other people. And it's through that process that sort of civilization happens and you know, we all kind of progress. And so so it's all about the individual as the point of focus. You know, there's, you know, in economics, you know, and if you watch the news today, there's this real, it's all about aggregates, like groups, like the overall demand in the economy, or like GDP, like everyone's obsessed with GDP figures. But, you know, my interest is really kind of peeling this back and starting from the beginning. And so I suppose you know, the one thing that I really found interesting was this phenomenon of inflation, and that's sort of what I really wanted to try and explore in this film, because I think it's something that's really misunderstood. And once again, going back to my own school study of economics, inflation was. Well, first of all, what is it? I mean, it's sort of defined as prices rising. Like if, you know, the cost of your living goes up, that's inflation. Here in Australia, they use this thing called the CPI, the Consumer Price Index. that supposedly measures inflation, measures the increase in prices. And it was explained to me as like a naturally occurring phenomenon as a result of economic activity. Like, you know, the good times that we spoke about, the boom in the business cycle when business is good and economic activity is flourishing, you get this inflation, you know, somehow it wasn't really explained as to exactly why, but it was like a naturally occurring part of economic activity, and that it sort of fluctuates and like it can get too high, but that's not good. And so the government needs to come in and do something. And also you don't want it to get too low. Like the worst thing would be for us to have falling prices. Like that's what can crash the economy. So once again, it's sort of explained as if it's this thing that happens naturally, but like it kind of can go either way out of control. And it's really up to the authorities to somehow, you know, keep it in line. And in Australia, the central bank, that's their job. And one of their mandates is to keep inflation at 2%. Like that's this magic number where they've got to keep it. So I guess my goal is to try and explain why that's wrong and why I think the central bank, you know, is really not a helping part of the economy. Like I really actually think they're part of the problem here. And it's like, you know, the arsonist setting a fire and then coming in to put it out and trying to tell you what a good job they've done. I know that's a lot of information to try and take in. So I just stop and take a breath and think about the best way to go on with this. But you know, yeah, I think if what we can get one thing out of this conversation, it'll be trying to get people to think about the idea of inflation, even if they've never thought about it before, why it actually might affect them and be an issue for them, even though, you know, they might not realize it. So I think, you know, the first point is that I don't think in an economy where people are just left to themselves to run their businesses, to buy the things they want, inflation isn't actually a naturally occurring side effect of that. You actually would get the opposite. Like, you know, where human ingenuity in terms of economic activity actually should cause prices to go down because, you know, we're getting better at making things. You know, we make better things, we make them cheaper. That's sort of that's progress, like that's productivity. And you can see that really evidently in industries like technology and computers. And like think about the iPhone, like 10 years ago, that didn't even exist. And then when it first came out, it's really expensive. You know, same with like a big screen TV or a computer. You know, now you've got in your pocket or in your hand this amazing piece of technology that's really cheap. Whereas if you go back 10, 20, 30 years, you know, those things either didn't exist or were really, really expensive. So, you know, that process should really be, that's a natural process and that should be making our life better. And the only way that inflation, like the only way that prices actually go up is because for somehow there's more money around. Like if you think about the economy in a really simple terms of goods on one side and prices on the other, money on the other. Like every single transaction that we engage in is always money on one side and goods on the other. So inflation is really to do with the money side, not the good side. So if there's all of a sudden more money being produced, chasing the same amount of stuff, of goods, that's actually the thing that is making prices go up. And the only people who have the ability to increase the amount of money is the central bank. Like in the US, it's the Federal Reserve. In Australia, it's the Reserve Bank of Australia. Like they're the ones in control of the money supply. And they sort of increase that supply And, you know, in their words, it's this attempt to keep the economy in control and on a certain track and pull, you know, to somehow fine tune it. But really, it's them that are creating the inflation that they're, you know, and if they just stepped aside and let things happen naturally, then you wouldn't actually get inflation. You'd potentially get the opposite. And it's interesting if you look back through history, particularly in the 19th century, you know, before you really had these, you know, if you look at the US or Europe, before you had this really persistent phenomenon of central banking and you had more of a gold standard where gold was used as money and money, current national currency insofar as it existed, was linked to gold and backed by gold, you actually had this process of deflation where things got cheaper over the course of decades or even the most of the century. Like that's a really bizarre thing for us to think about now. We're just used to stuff being more expensive now than it was in our parents' generation. But yeah, that's actually a, you know, a result of this era of central banking. And so I guess the next question that someone may ask is, well, okay, that's fair enough. Maybe I agree. Maybe you make a point, but why is that important? Like, you know, prices going up, perhaps my wage is also going up. Like why does it matter? But I guess the reason it matters is that it's a phenomenon that's created by the government, and it's like a hidden tax. So, I sort of have a view of the world, which you can accuse me of being simplistic, and we could maybe later get into some of the nuance of this, but you know, that you've got the free market on one side and the government on the other. And I think that, you know, if left to it, the more that you can leave the free market and people running businesses and making decisions based on what they want to buy, the more you can leave them to do their thing to themselves, the better off we'll all be. And you have the government coming in, trying to regulate, trying to manipulate things, or in the name of improving something. But really, I think that most of the time they're just making it worse. And the main way that the government has to roll out the programs that it wants to and to, is to tax. Like, we all pay income tax, we pay goods and services tax every time we buy something, and the government uses that money to to spend, whether it's on defense or social programs or all sorts of things, you know, the various merits of which can all be debated. But in all the countries of the Western world, Australia being an obvious example, but even more so in places like Europe or Japan or the US, the governments can't bring in enough money in taxes to pay for all the stuff that they want to do. You know, and you can see this, that all the governments are in debt. Like, they've got huge amounts of government debt, and they every year they add to that debt because they spend more money than they earn. So there's no way that they could do all the things that they want to do through simply taxing us, even though tax rates are high. You know, for a lot of people, they're up to 50% of what you earn just goes straight to the government. So inflation is a way that they can increase their ability to spend without directly being seen to tax, because they've got the ability to print money. You know, the central bank is kind of, inverted commas, it's an independent institution, but I think it's more sensible to really view it as another branch of the government. You know, they really do sort of work together. And they have this interesting system where the government will issue debt, like a bond, but then, you know, that's like any company or person issuing debt or going into debt. The idea being that you're supposed to then have to pay that back, you know, sometime in the future. But what we get happening more and more today is that instead of the government paying that money back with the taxes that it raises, it simply gets a central bank to print the money, that is create the money out of nothing. Like, in, you know, in the old days, they literally would have run off the currency, like literally created the notes, whereas now it mainly happens digitally. It's literally just the money is created on a computer and the central bank buys that debt and sort of puts it away almost like never to be seen again. And it's this process of monetizing the debt. So the government's run up all this debt and they never really have to pay it back because the central bank buys it all up and almost kind of puts it away. And the result of that is over the long term, this slow and steady decline of the value of your money. And that is why we're seeing prices go up. Because those two things are one and the same. Like if one day something costs a dollar and the next day the same thing costs $2, well, it's not necessarily that the thing got more expensive. It's actually that the value of your dollar went down. The purchasing power of your dollar went down because you need more of those dollars to buy the same thing. And so this is what I mean when it's like a hidden tax, like it's a transfer of purchasing power from the people, you know, in a country to the government, without them having to directly tax it or directly win support for those policies through the political process. And you might say, oh, look, they're using it for good things, whether that's health or education, but the reality is that those things weren't voted on by the citizens of the country. And it's my view that more and more that it's used for things that actually wouldn't technically be popular. Like going to war is a great example. Like if you look back at the First World War and the Second World War, you had this gold standard where money was tied to gold. And then the countries wanted to go to war with each other. But war is an incredibly expensive thing. Like it costs millions and millions of dollars. And so in order to fund these wars, you'll see countries break the link between gold and the money and just create as much money as they can out of paper and devalue. So when you get to the end of the war, they might have spent millions and millions of dollars and funded the war. And at the end of the day, it's the citizens of the country who are left with a vastly devalued currency. And a modern version of that would be like the war in Afghanistan that we've just seen. Everyone's seen that in the news the last week or so, the US pulling out and the Taliban coming back in. So like 20 years for what, I guess? And the bill for that was like $2 trillion. The only way the US government was able to fund that war was by going into debt, as much debt as possible, and having the central bank create money out of nothing and buy that debt. And you'll see politicians calling for higher taxes, increasing the income tax on the highest earners of the population, wealth taxes, capital gains taxes. But the reality is that those taxes would only be enough to fund the government for some very short period of time, like a month or months. Like the only way they can sort of keep this scheme going is by going into more and more debt and doing more and more money printing. And they use these terms like quantitative easing or yield curve control or kind of all these fancy terms that you might see in a newspaper and go, I wonder exactly what they're doing. But it's all really just a euphemism for creating money out of nothing. And I think that the end result of that, whether it's now or in 10 years' time or in 20 years' time, they're very good at kicking the can down the road. But I think the end result of that somewhere has to be the collapse of the money. Like I think that there's no other end point to the way the system works. It's just hard to predict exactly when that's going to happen.
So let's take right now, for example, in Australia. I was speaking to somebody the other day and we're now in August 2021. There's a big lockdown happening across most of the country. I was speaking to a business owner and they said something to me the other day, which was quite fascinating and shocking. Their business is being paid, I'll give you their figures, $40,000 a week to be closed. They don't have to pay any of their staff. The government is paying their staff, I think it's $750 a week per person, tax-free. The business doesn't have to pay rent. And this business has made more money in the last year by basically being shut than they've ever made in their lives. And that's one business. So they're making more money by being shut, by not providing any goods or services, and their staff are being paid without having to work. And it blew my mind because each and every week that business is getting that much money. Those staff are getting that much money. Now, times that by however many businesses there are in Australia. And the question I have, the first question, I was like, well, where is this money coming from? How long is it going to be paid for? And what are the effects of that short-term and long-term? And the other thought that came to my mind was the rallies that have been happening around this country. You know, there's a few people there, you know, in the thousands, maybe the tens of thousands, depending on which rally you're at or which city you're at. But it got me thinking that why would people want to be protesting and rallying at the moment if they're getting paid to basically be at home and the business owners are being paid quite handsomely to shut their business? I mean, who in their right mind would be campaigning against that if there's an incentive for them to get paid, you know? And I guess the question I've got for you is, where is this headed if it continues? You know, because the amount of money, I tried to work it out, is just bewildering. And on the other hand, there's small businesses out there and there's people that are out of work. They're probably the ones that are campaigning and protesting and rallying. So there seems to be a lot of confusion and a lot of hypocrisy, and it's not equal across the board, which maybe that's done on purpose. I'm not sure.
Yes, I think everything you've said is correct and really interesting. And I can certainly empathize. I'm running a business myself, you know, a small business. And, you know, we went through this same process of getting shut down. You know, we're still shut down. You know, that's been almost, you know, a year and a half now. And, you know, although, you know, we've been having the same process. You know, we've been getting a check each week, certainly recently. And you know, all through last year, the, you know, the salaries of the employees were getting paid by the government. You know, where, and as you say, it sort of seems to be a different situation for everyone. We're seeing this money come into the business account, but from our point of view, it's not enough to, you know, it's barely enough to sort of keep the doors open. In fact, it's sort of not enough to keep the doors open. But then, you know, you've got other businesses that seem to be doing really well. And it's almost like it's in the hands of some kind of bureaucrat to make the decision. What's an essential business and what's not? What kind of business can stay open and what has to shut? And if you do have to shut, who decides how much money you get? And like I've spent most of the year sort of applying for all these complex kind of government grants here or there. And you know, if a decision on someone's desk in an office somewhere, or a mistake, or whether you write the correct thing or the wrong thing on a piece of paper, like decides whether you get $100,000 here or not there. So yes, that's the first thing is that, you know, it becomes quite arbitrary as to how this money is doled out. And, you know, some people are probably doing well off it, you know, better than they were doing before. And then for others, especially those running small businesses, are struggling. And so, yeah, when you try and do the maths on this money and you know, where it's coming from, yeah, it's a good question. And the issue is that in the very short term, there doesn't seem to be any consequence. Like, there doesn't seem like there's any immediate problem. Like, you know, the government can create this money effectively with no cost. Like, they can make as much money as they want, you know, so the states can go into debt, the federal government can go into more debt. Like, our government has a debt to GDP ratio of something like, I haven't checked in a while, but maybe 60 or 70%, which means that, you know.
I really hope you enjoyed the first half of this podcast. If you'd like to listen to the rest, please visit evolvenetwork.tv. That's evolvenetwork.tv. We'll see you there.
The information, views, and opinions expressed in this podcast should not be treated as a substitute for nutritional, medical, or other advice by a qualified professional. Guests in this podcast express their own opinions, experiences, and conclusions. Nothing in this podcast should be used to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any medical condition. Neither Pete Evans nor any sponsor endorse any views, opinions, or conclusions expressed or shared in this podcast.